Thank you for being here. Thank you for coming into the library, even though there is wonderful sunshine out there. I will try to keep my sort of introductory note short. There are programs out here. If you haven't seen them, there's programs also about the schedule and what we are planning to do in the next hour or so. And I have my script that I can read. First of all, I would like to welcome George Butler. Thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing with us your art and the sort of mélissage, which is something in between. It's not the sort of opening, it's not the closing, it's somewhat in between of this exhibition. Of your work, an exhibition that is a collaboration between the three clusters, the current two cluster and the previous cluster, who are all interested in these topics, and the Zukunftskolleg. Let me just take the opportunity. Normally on today is a Wednesday. Tuesday. Today is Tuesday. Today is Tuesday. So every Tuesday we have a Jour fixe in the Zukunftskolleg. And every Tuesday in the Jour fixe we welcome new people. When we have new people. And today I would like to welcome Eliana Barriga and Patricia Nabucco Martuscelli, who are here. Yes. One is here, the other unfortunately not. Welcome our new fellows to share also the time with us. Thank you. And of course, we start with thanking a lot of people, because this exhibition and these also collaborations wouldn't be possible with the participation of many people. And so I have a long, long list that I prepared, and it filled three pages. And then I said, no, I'll stop. I will not say thank you to every single one of them. But I would like to have just three people, apart from all the people in the Zukunftskolleg and in the clusters, and which I will not name. But I would like to name Mr. Gabel, Mr. Krasny, and Mr. Meyer. These are the janitors, the house deans at the university. Because the way and the strength that they put into just getting the technology right to hang the paintings, right? It seems so trivial, right? You just see them there and you think, okay, it's easy, that's it, right? But it's not. Right? It's not. And having people who have been sort of asked to hang this there and that probably thought I'll be done in 10 minutes and then come here and find problems and then don't say, no, I only have 10 minutes, I go home, but really put all the love for our university into this. I think that is exceptional. So I would like to thank them even though they are not here, so they will not hear this. I have a long script, but I'll skip over this. I'll tell you a little bit of a background. The Zukunftskolleg since 2 years now is in an international network, that is UBIAS network. This is the University-Based Institutes of Advanced Studies. This is a network of 40 institutions all across the world, institutes of advanced studies. And one thing that this UBIAS network does is they choose a topic of the year. Every year, a different topic. And then within every one of these institutions, that topic is somewhat covered with seminars, with research, with talks, with different things. And the topic of the year this year is migration. And so when we had this topic, migration, we thought, well, migration, that is not something very peculiar only to the Zukunftskolleg. This is also something that is very central, for example, animal migration in the cluster collective behavior. Right? Or migration of people across the world in the cluster politics of inequality or in the cultural foundations of social integration. And so we thought we'd team up and do this exhibition together. And that is interesting because of its diversity and of the different points where it captures politics, it captures sociology, it captures history, it captures animal biology. It captures also the large groups of migrating people and refugees that we had in particular over the last few years. And here came the idea of having George Butler join us. with his art, because George Butler has gone to places where refugees are. And I will tell you a little bit more about his work in a minute. Now what I'll do is the following. I will give you, and this I will read so that it's faster, I will give you a very short overview of our speakers today that come from the different initiatives. And I will make this an exercise in memory for you. You have the programs, and they are around here. If you haven't gotten them, then just have a look there on the different tables. And I will give you a short overview of the speakers in a different sequence of how they speak afterwards, so that you can then connect the speaker to the right person. Claudia Diehl is professor for sociology since 2013 with a focus on microsociology at the university here. Her main research area is international migration movements, sociocultural and edification integration processes of immigrants, with special consideration of generational change, as well as ethnic demarcation processes such as xenophobia and discrimination. She's a member of the Scientific Advisory Board for Family Issues at the Federal Ministry for Family Affairs, Senior Citizens, Women and Youth. Who would ever call a ministry that way? I don't know. Andrea Flack is currently a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Migration at the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior in Radolfzell. Her main research explores the impact of social interactions on small and large migratory behavior in white storks. Prior to that, she conducted her PhD at the University of Oxford, investigating collective navigation in homing pigeons. And before that, she did her diploma in biological sciences at the Free University in Berlin, studying honeybee navigation and communication. Gisela Kopp is a primatologist with research interests at the interface between evolutionary biology, behavioral ecology, and population genetics. She completed her PhD at the University of Göttingen and the German Primate Center in 2015, where she investigated how differences in social systems influence population genetic patterns in wild baboons. She joined the University of Konstanz and the Max Planck Institute of Ornithology, at that time now Animal Behavior, as a postdoctoral scientist in 2016, working on the evolutionary causes and consequences of variation in social systems. In 2018, she received the Hector Pioneer Fellowship at the Zukunftskolleg, where she is currently building her research group. Daniel Thiem is the speaker of his own department and is not here right now because he is in the middle of a discussion within the department, but he might be able to join us just in time to give his talk. So I'm still telling you what I have here about him. He holds the Jean Monnet Chair of European, International and Public Law at the University of Konstanz, and is a co-director of the Research Center Immigration and Asylum Law at here. He has worked at the Walter Hallenstein Institute for European Constitutional Law at the Humboldt University in Berlin. Is an editor of the European Law Journal and principal investigator in the Cluster of Excellence Cultural Foundations of Social Integration. He regularly appears as an expert witness in the Home Affairs Committee of the German Bundestag, contributes to the Pan-European Judicis Academic Network of Legal Experts in Immigration and Asylum Law, and has published widely on diverse issues about law. Nihan Tropakiran is a postdoctoral researcher at the Zukunftskolleg, affiliated with the Department of Politics and Public Administration. She received her BA in Political Science and International Relations from Boğaziçi University in Turkey, and her Master of Science in Comparative Social Policy from the University of Oxford. For her PhD at the University of York, she focused on the development of social rights and welfare regimes in the context of middle-income countries. Nian's current work is about the political behavior of immigrants, with particular emphasis on the links between their rights and integration in the country of residence and their views on home country politics. And Lorenz Wiese is a PhD, is a just recent PhD in his Department of Politics and Public Administration at the University of Konstanz and the Center of Excellence Cultural Foundations of Social Integration. In his doctoral thesis, he compared the asylum and refugee regimes in Australia, Canada, and Germany. Before that, he completed a Master of Arts in Politics and Public Administration, specializing on international administration and conflict management. Now, the reason I had all these now as a sort of bulk is because I think it's much better afterwards when we have the lightning talks to just have the content and try to find connections between the different talks. So let me tell you two sentences about our artist, and then George will also tell something about his view of his art much later. He and the two sentences are just he went to these places. He went to the small and empty town of Azaz, which is when he walked from Turkey across the border into Syria, where he was a guest of the rebel Free Syrian Army and had a direct on-site experience of the civil war there. He also visited refugee camps in the Bica Valley, in the oil fields of Azerbaijan, in Gaza, where he went with Oxfam, in the Tajikistan, in Afghanistan, in Myanmar, in Syria, in Iraq, and in Yemen, and other places. And he has, which I think you will talk about, his own view as to the relationship between photography as opposed to drawing places and drawing, putting experiences and visual scenes into drawing. A lot of that I think you can see right away when you look at his paintings, which I think are very, very impressive. Thank you very much for being here, and I would suggest we jump right into the lightning talks. I give my microphone to the first speaker, who is George.
Well, thank you for having me. This is my first oh my god, the time has started already. My first exhibition in Germany, I think. I don't really know anything about your clusters or indeed science, but I am going to now talk for 2 minutes, 40 seconds about the things that I've seen. This all came about because I think when I think about migration, I either think about swallows or storks flying from Africa to Europe, or I think about Syrians in boats trying to get across the Mediterranean. And I think one of the greatest challenges that faces humanity this century, especially with the kind of Earth as a finite resource and population increase, is this idea of that we all exist on this planet as one sort of one biomass, and that losses to sort of ancient forests or indeed sort of extinctions of other species are also a loss to us as human beings. So these drawings are sort of done with the idea of bringing different species together and also our own different communities within the world. As David Attenborough said the other day, the Garden of Eden is no more. And I think migration is one of the indicators, one of the ways that as someone who is an artist and not a scientist can see that, can kind of visually compare the way that humans move and the way that animals move. Even as an artist, I can see that we need that different species need to breed, to mate, to look after their young, to build homes, and migration is one of the ways that that is done for the chance of at a better future. I think in the Western world, certainly in Britain, and this exhibition came out in England at the same time as our disastrous Brexit decision. So I think the Western world, we often think of migration as a burden on us. It's something that's wanted of our society. It's something that at the best we feel sorry for the people doing it, at worst we just try and build a bigger wall. And these five or six places, Kenya, Syria, the middle of Europe, Tajikistan, were all places where migration is ordinary. People and animals there will expect in their lifetimes to move for work, for love, in fear, whatever it is. They will do it without thinking, really. They'll often consider the place that they've left still to be home, but they will do it without as it's neither innately good or inherently bad. I suppose if there's a message that comes with this in the next century, which will only see migration influence the way the world works as humans do it more and animals do it less, the message is really to be less intimidated by this very, very ordinary process. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to present a perspective from biology today, because I think it's important to talk a little bit about the terminology, which we use the same terms like people in other disciplines, but we might mean a little bit something different. So to make comparisons, I think, between biology and the social sciences easier, I just want to clarify that a bit. When I talk about migrations in animals, I want to talk about three different types of movements that we usually see that exceed the usual daily ranging of animals in their usual territory. And they all occur across the whole animal kingdom and can be investigated both like only in individuals or on whole populations. And the first one here, where Andrea will talk in more detail later, is migration. And in biology, in the strict sense, when we talk about migration, we mean the movement away and the subsequent return to the same location on a regular basis. So regular can be either like seasonal or daily. Seasonal movements are, for example, these bird migrations, for example, that we see that but also occur in insects or in other mammals, where animals maybe live in the northern hemisphere during summer and then migrate in winter to the southern hemisphere. These evolve because the benefits of translocating somewhere where the resources are better are greater, the benefits are bigger than actually the disadvantages that the individuals have from staying in, from moving these like very far, sometimes several thousand kilometers. And a different kind of movement that we see in animals is dispersal, and here we mean the movement of single individuals or maybe a handful of individuals from their place of birth to a different place to breed, or sometimes between the breeding sites. So this is something that is often actually sex biased in many species. So it's often mainly one sex that disperses in most human societies, but not in all. It's the women that leave their natal home to move somewhere else. But it's something that we also see across all animals. And here the evolutionary explanation is that it's to avoid inbreeding. So one sex leaves their natal home to go somewhere else to avoid the risk to breed with relatives. The third type of movements that we usually investigate in biology, and that is different from these two other ones, is when individuals expand their range. So we talk about range expansions when animals move to a new region and alter the species distribution. And this is often caused by, for example, climatic shifts or because some barriers to migration break down. And one example here for in humans, for example, is the expansion of modern humans that evolved in Africa out of Africa over the whole globe.
I work on a very iconic migrant. I think next to the swallows or swifts, the white stork is very famous for its migration. Everybody knows the stork. And I'm lucky that I study storks using these kind of fancy tracking devices these days. We put these GPS loggers that are charged using solar panels on the storks. And with that, we can track them from their first movement out of the nest throughout their entire life. We find we can follow their entire movements. We can see how they learn to fly. We can see where they stop during their migration. And we can find see where they overwinter, and if we're lucky enough, or not so lucky for the stork, we can even see when, where, and how the stork dies. And with this technology, we nowadays have quite a big knowledge on where the storks go. We know very well their routes along these different migratory corridors. We know their wintering grounds in Africa or southern Africa, so we can really estimate their costly journeys during their life, and really not only of the ones here in Europe, but also all the way of the storks in Eastern Europe, in Asia, and of Northern Africa. And a lot of my work actually focuses not so much. I will not blame that. on the migration of the individual, but of the migration of the flocks. So my work looks at the interaction between individuals while they fly. Storks hardly ever go anywhere alone. And they aggregate in these huge groups and use each other as a source of information during their migratory flight. Using each other as an information source allows them to save energy during flight by looking at each other and finding optimal flight conditions for their migratory journey. We can see how they circle together in these huge groups in thermals, and really we find these individual differences between the storks. Some storks are very bad flyers, some others are very good flyers, and they aggregate together and take this journey together and benefit from each other during their migration. And I'm a bit faster. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. Today, of course, I'm also standing here as a political scientist, but primarily, I would say, as a human being. And as a political scientist, I've been spending most of my last years trying to investigate the differences and similarities between the asylum and refugee regimes of different countries and regions around the world, including Australia, Canada, Germany, or Latin American countries. And I wrote comprehensive studies about all that, and as you can imagine, it would exceed the scope of these few minutes to tell you all that I have found out. So I would rather take the chance to point out to one very central similarity that I've come across. This central similarity is that in none of the countries that I've studied so far, migrants themselves are perceived as subjects who have a voice of their own. Instead, we conduct research about them, we formulate policies to govern their movements, but we barely ask for the opinions of the concerned populations. I would just like to remind everyone that it's one thing to investigate how animals migrate. Animals have no voice, or maybe we don't understand the voice or the language that they speak. Human migration, in turn, is a bit different in that humans do have a voice. Of course, there are many reasons not to treat human beings like animals. But I do not want to bore you with the list of moral, ethical considerations now. I would rather use this chance on this hot day to focus on migrants' voices, as my scientific work has enabled me to listen to these voices very clearly in the last years. To actually hear these voices, in turn, requires a willingness to listen, and maybe an interpreter, or nowadays, nothing more than a translation software. The most important point of this talk today is that migrants themselves are the ones who often have by far the most expertise on the subjects, on the issues that concern them. We should never forget that. Given the short time available, I would like to illustrate that with a real-world example of so-called anecdotal evidence from a young Pakistani who I've met in 2017 in a detention center in Australia. He does not want his name to be mentioned for security reasons, but I called him back now, some years later, and asked how he's doing, and I will not quote his words. At home in Pakistan, I had been under attack by a militant group because I was converted from Sunni Muslim to a Shia Muslim. I worked for a social organization for the Shia community, providing security to minority religious places, especially Shia Muslim and Christian communities. This organization had become very famous for standing against radical Muslims. We also gave free surgeries and treatment to people in need. Also, my great-grandfather was a high-ranking priest in my hometown. All this made me a prominent person and a successful businessman. But the fundamentalists persecuted me. They targeted me, tried to kill me, and so I had to leave. You see the attacks and bombings so often in my country. To Australia, I came alone. I don't have any family member here with me. I left everyone back in Pakistan. I asked for protection at the airport, but from the airport, directly upon arrival, they put me into prison. I was detained for 3 years and 3 months, and finally released from the detention center in July 2017. But the Australian administration still refuses my case. I was put in a fast-track procedure without any of the usual formal guarantees. I appealed at the court, but they refused the review. Now my last chance would be to present more evidence, but how? Since I'm living in a community in Melbourne, I'm facing financial hardship. I don't have any job and can only work as a volunteer. I don't have a right to study and I don't get any financial support from the government. They gave me a 6 months bridging visa. With a 6 months visa condition, no one gives us a permanent job. After every 6 months, I have to go to the immigration office to renew my visa. In the meantime, I'm considered an illegal migrant. which scares me. Are they going to renew my visa or going to send me back to the detention center or even back to Pakistan? So I'm still living in constant uncertainty and fear. One guy who was in the same detention center with me was deported back to Bangladesh and murdered right after arrival. Heartbreaking. I need to see a psychiatrist and barely can sleep. In my dreams, I still see my bed in Pakistan full of blood and bullets. We all came to Australia with a lot of hope and energy, only looking for safety and peace. They put us in prison for several years without committing any crime. There we lost all our hope and self-confidence in the first years after arrival. It is very painful having to ask even for pocket money from my friends out here in the community, having been rich and successful earlier in my life. They tie our hands. We cannot do anything. So how are we supposed to contribute to this country? We feel like beggars. Many Australians are very nice, but the government is not. So why doesn't this country just resign from the Geneva Convention? This would be more honest at least. So ladies and gentlemen, all this may sound very far away and exotic as an example from the Australian case, but there's more parallels to the situation of refugees and migrants in the EU and Germany than many of us would be aware or willing to accept. In particular, many migrants are being criminalized and marginalized because it seems politically convenient at this point in time. Our task as privileged academics or policy consultants who have the resources to understand and change this system should be to recognize these parallels very clearly and to learn from each other in order to avoid people being treated like animals and imprisoned for deterrence reasons. In the area of human migration, we should demand policies, research and media reports that allow migrants to speak for themselves. And to put one more controversial sentence in the end, I know I've exceeded the time by far, but anyway, research in this area that does not aim at reducing human suffering is not worth doing. Thank you.
Hello. Well, the word migration puts the emphasis on the initial act of migrating. However, in my talk today, I'll rather focus on what happens after migration, especially in terms of the ties that immigrants keep with their countries of origin for a very long time, sometimes even across generations. Well, one interesting example is political ties, and in particular, the practice of external voting, that is voting in national elections from abroad. Today, more than 120 countries recognize the right to external vote for their citizens abroad. And to give a better idea about the scope of this phenomenon, I have three maps here showing the spread of external voters for the most recent national elections in Turkey, Poland and Italy. And the darker colors on the maps indicate a higher number of external voters in that country. So for 2018 Turkish elections, there were polling stations established in 61 countries, most voters being concentrated in Western Europe and Northern America. In Polish elections, in 2015 Polish elections, immigrants voted in 87 countries in person or through postal voting. And although external voting was geographically more widespread in the Polish case, the high numbers of Polish voters were only present in the US, the UK and Germany. And finally, for Italian elections in 2018, there was participation from 140 countries against through postal voting, with a high number of Italian voters in quite a few countries all around the world. Overall, I would say this means there is an impressive number of people who are settled elsewhere but are still interested in having a say in politics back home, which I find a very interesting phenomenon in itself. Well, Another thing to remark on these maps is that Germany is one of the main immigration countries with a high number of external voters from different origins. And my current research focuses on these three groups in Germany, namely Turkish, Polish, and Italian, and tries to explain their external political preferences. And the starting point for this project was the observation that some immigrant groups are particularly likely to support populist parties and movements in their countries of origin. And I thought this constitutes a puzzling situation because immigrants would not support the same ideas in their countries of residence, such as anti-immigration, anti-European attitudes, or opposition to liberal democratic institutions and representation. So that's basically what I'm trying to understand, and I'm hoping to find out potential ways in which their experience as immigrants in Germany might be connected to their views on home country politics and political preferences. Thanks for your attention.
Yeah,
So the question that I chose for this lightning event is, does migrants' religiosity matter for their integration? So, and it's a question from integration research. Research on human migration, social science research on human migration, is actually about three broad fields. It's about really movements, cross-border movements. It's about integration, and it's about reactions of the majority, like xenophobia and discrimination. Due to data availability, actually most empirical research is about what happens after migration and about the reactions of the majority to a growing diversity, and not so much about population movements that are very difficult to study data-wise. What is integration? That would be a fascinating topic for another lightning talk, but I have only one. So I give you a very short technical definition. It's basically, we call it a similar distribution of characteristics of majority and minority members. Think about unemployment. Same unemployment rate in both groups would be an indicator for integration. One very contested question in integration research is the question why origin groups differ with respect to the pace of their integration process. And one very popular explanation is, does migrants' religious background matter? So for example, in the German context, Turks' comparatively slow integration process is often attributed to the fact that they are Muslims. This is a seemingly logical reasoning. So in many European countries, Muslims lag behind in terms of their integration. So people do form a link between those two things. I never really believed that. So what we did is something that is very simple, and we were really wondering that there's not so much research on that before we started, is we looked at micro-level data from Germany, and we said, well, if this reasoning is true, then you would see that secular Turks integrate at a faster pace than religious ones, for instance, in core fields of their integration, like the educational system or the labor market. So is this the case? That's the lightning. Can you go on? It's not. So we don't see any difference in these core fields like educational integration, labor market integration, between secular or religious Muslims. So, but what else is it? It's easy to say no to one explanation without having another one. So what I think is happening, and there's a lot of empirical evidence for that, is when Muslim immigrants came to many European countries, including Germany, they had lower educational levels than other groups. Due to the inheritance of disadvantage, due to the inheritance of low parental education that we see particularly in the German context, there was a transmission of this disadvantage to their children. And the third thing that went on was what we call ethnic replenishment. So we had for this group an ongoing immigration of very low-skilled individuals from Turkey as spouses, men and women. So what you see here, you can ignore most of the graph, but just look at the first-generation Turks. This year, you see that between the year 2000 and the year 2012, in the group of those who immigrated themselves, the share of those with less than primary education actually increased. And that, of course, throws their integration process a little bit back every time a new migration movement is coming. The good news is that migration from Turkey of very low-skilled individuals has basically come to a standstill. By now, mostly students are coming, actually. Thank you.
Any comments, any additional observations, things that you might want to contribute?
I have a short question regarding your talk about the animal migration definitions. You said the last term was expansion. When some animals want to go for new areas because they need, for instance, to escape climate change. But how do you call this if they need to escape from one area to go for a new one, because then actually it's no expansion. It's a colonization. Okay.
Or a range shift. So if you like, what I mean in the range expansion is that you keep your original range, but expand to the new area. But you could also have the colonization so that a subset moves somewhere else, and then like what happens to the original population is not so important. Or if you have a shift, is for example, and if the climatic conditions get so bad in your original range, is that you completely leave that range and go somewhere else.
Thanks. My question is, there was some idea behind putting animal migration and human migration next to each other. Probably the first who had this idea was you. But my question is, are there some comparable traits of animal and human migration? We discussed it in the group that kind of organizes this event, and what came to my mind is this wall concept, you know, trying to keep people and animals to their territories. And this seems, in that way, there might be some way of comparing these two different kinds of migration. So I think I would like to have some of you to answer.
I could say something. I think what becomes clear in this comparison is when you look at the animal kingdom, is that like movements, like migration or like other kinds of movements, are so widespread, like in nearly every animal species, they migrate in the term that we would call migration in humans. So, and if we see humans just as another animal species, like not in a way that you said that like treating them like animals is like treating them worse, but they're just like a normal animal that migrates and goes, if the conditions where you are get so bad that the costs of like moving somewhere else are less than what the advantages you get in a new place, then it's just humans do like every other animal would also.
First of all, it struck me that the definitions that you went through could very easily be applied to both sides of this sort of tale. But I think the thing that I found shocking coming back from places like Syria and Iraq and Yemen this year was that if we were to apply, there's a very cynical kind of idea whereby you could try and round up all the birds that flew from here back to Africa, or herd certain animals into, as you say, walls. But the idea of that is completely insane. And yet, to do it when it comes to humans is something that we've all become accepting of. It's something that that we just need to do on the off chance that we will all be better off. And that, I suppose, was a reason for, I guess, having seen those people who are sitting in camps or behind walls or are standing at, there's one of a man standing at a fence, the old barbed wire fence is on the floor and the new one is being built between Idomeni and Serbia, and just looking down the railway line that he wanted to walk, and I'm sure animals, birds flying over at the same day. So I guess that's my only comment.
No, I can't give an expert answer, but I think the reactions of those who were first, they are very similar, and they are scaringly similar. I mean, you can even observe that when you enter a train compartment with some people already sitting there. I mean, they don't have any more right to sit there. They were just first, and that makes a big difference. And if you look at animals, cats, if another cat enters their territory, they are not nice. And in this respect, we should try to be better than animals.
Yeah, even though I work for you, I have a question for you, Claudia. We will have time to talk later, sure. You said that religiosity doesn't that much come into integration, or the feeling of not being integrated, and economic and political disadvantage in migrants. And then you said that education and inherited disadvantage from low education parents does come in a lot. So how do education and religiosity correlate? Is there a connection between the two?
Yes, so what I always try to point out, and many people really don't believe it, is that on a very simple, when you look at it very simply, you don't see that religious Muslims have less German friends, speak the language less well than secular ones. They don't have worse grades, and they don't go to worse schools. One objection to this argument is that there might still be an indirect influence of religiosity. So why were the migrants who came to Germany from Turkey less educated than those who came from Italy? This might be an indirect cultural influence of Islam. I don't know. And I can't think of any data, how you could look into that. That's, you have to talk to historians and people like that, I think.
Neha, really interesting your work. I have not a question, but to know how you are dealing with it. In the Brazilian elections last year, we saw really interesting the vote of Brazilians outside Brazil in the presidential elections. And there was a huge difference depending on where the community was. So, for example, in Berlin, the leftist party won far, far. And if we go to Zurich, the right party won by far. I don't know if you see any, if you were able previously to see anything like that, if you are considering difference depending on the city here in Germany, and how this influenced your research question.
The first thing which made me think of this question was actually the results of the Turkish elections, because the current governing party got even higher support among immigrants as compared to the support that they get in Turkey, which is very high to begin with. So the question was why immigrants would support like a right-wing populist nationalist party even more than people in Turkey. And then I compared this, and Germany is one of the countries where this party got the very highest level of votes among all other countries as well. And I compared this to the results in other two countries. So like I checked the situation with the Italians and the Polish, and I've seen that like the support that similar parties, it's difficult to say because populism is a very loose concept as well. But like populist parties in this particular cases also got very high levels of support, not higher than what they get in the homeland, but still like almost comparable levels of support. And in this case, it's even more intriguing because these are more openly like anti-Europe and anti-immigrants and everything. So that's how the whole comparison came. So the question was first, why Turkish people are even more likely than people in Turkey to do this, and also like in a broader way, why do we have this phenomenon as a broader phenomenon of populist support for parties back home? So that's how it came. And like in terms of differences among the cities, I can't really tell anything because it was really high all around Germany in the Turkish case.
Maybe I would have a question to Lorenz Wiese. The last statement that as a political scientist, you need to have a human motivation and also a human task that you want to fulfill. These are like two different motivations to do research. How do you put them together to not influence the one with the other?
So from my perspective, as not a mere researcher, but also an activist, I have to say they do influence each other and they need to influence each other. That does not mean that everybody has to find this his or her way of dealing with that, but for me, it's the only way to make sense out of it. And when I said that research that does not aim at reducing human suffering in the area of human migration is not worth being done, that was actually a controversial point that I wanted to open the discussion with. Unfortunately, Daniel Thum is not here, because I think we could have entered a great debate onto that. So I'm lucky that you asked. I've actually come across this question quite often. I don't really know how to make sense of it, but for me, at this point in life, I have to say I cannot anymore have both hats and put one hat of the researcher aside and then put the activist hat on my head, but I have to combine the both. It doesn't leave me any other option, because things have gotten so terrible out there that we do have this responsibility, and we cannot say, oh, we are here in our university, we don't have to care about human suffering as long as we get our grant proposals and stuff like that.
I mean, I ultimately hope that something good will come out of my research. So this story I try to tell to as many people as possible to reduce prejudice towards Muslims. And I'm an activist too, but I'm a bike activist. So that's my political interest, yeah? And I really try to keep this apart, because I would be really in trouble if I had started this research and then I would have found that religiosity does affect integration processes a large deal. So what would I have done? Buried this, or, I mean, risk that this really, really enforces prejudice against Muslims? It's difficult.
And I totally agree with you too. But but I'm going to show my point, because I'm also an activist in the migration area, so I know it's kind of complicated. I think that one thing is conducting the research ethically following scientific procedures. But the question is what you are going to do with your results. So in your case, if you had found, for example, that there is actually a bigger difficulty for Muslims to integrate here in Germany, Turkish Muslims to integrate here in Germany, maybe your results could provide better ideas for public policies to address the situation. Or maybe you could frame it, not hide the result, but frame it in a way to diminish prejudice, thinking like, integrating these Muslims better or providing better public policies could improve, I don't know, local life in Germany, or could provide more jobs, or using any of arguments. So I think it's possible even when we find conducting a neutral scientific research, but what you do after, how you frame your results, what you are going to do with your results is important. And I think this is the part where the activist starts.
So that actually reminded me of your last talk when you used the concept of do no harm research. So at least if we do not try to improve the world, we can at least try to not make it worse. And I know that there have been researchers out there who actually contributed to policies that were implemented that actually made things worse. And that would be the bottom line, the baseline, which we should never cross, I guess, to not do any harm to the people out there just by researching and presenting the results of our research in the way that it could like influence policies to be even more contributing to human suffering. I don't want to mention any names, but actually it was a professor here at the university who influenced the designated safe countries of origin policy in Canada. He was asked by the Canadian government at the time to like share his ideas that were implemented already at the EU level and in Germany. And then Canada, for example, said, oh, why don't we do the same stuff? And that actually had a terrible impact for the people that could not find asylum in Canada anymore from that point on.
There is also some discussions on refugee studies area. There is also interdisciplinary from people conducting work in different areas with refugees on when you are thinking about refugees in your research, how you integrate this refugee. So if you are conducting an interview, how you are managing expectations, if you are sharing information with them, good information or bad information that can prevent them of, for example, achieving not status, legal status, but for example, public services. And there is also a new line in this literature that dialogues on how you conduct research, not for refugees, but with refugees, and also trying to involve the refugees themselves and migrants in the research process, trying to give them a type of voice, since considering their own expertise in this area.
I also have a follow-up question to Lorenz, but I was wondering if you can tell us a bit more about the concrete ways in which you are combining your research with the activism. Because looking at my own research, I'm basically trying to understand some mechanisms, and I'm mostly interested in seeing whether people's rights and integration here has an impact on their behavior, which is basically about expressing some sort of frustration or some sort of problem they're having here potentially. But in a way, I think it's worthwhile to understand this, but this is still a bit difficult to combine with any sort of activism. It might be obviously easier in the case of refugees, but I was just wondering if you can give us a few examples maybe about how you are making use of your research in this sense.
So I did never want to mention that everybody has to become an activist or anything like that, just because we have more knowledge than usual people out there about these topics. But in my case, it just came at the same time in my life that I found out about individual cases whom I could actually help, and that I got the knowledge, like the expertise on these topics. And for example, you need to know very, very clearly how the asylum system is set up, which are the different laws and different ways out and stuff like that, so that you can actually help people that do not have this expertise. So this is a normal example. The refugee law clinic here in Constance was actually set up by some students of Daniel Thüm, and they said, okay, we have the expertise, the legal expertise as law students to help asylum seekers find their rights, basically to assess their rights, because actually, yeah, the immigration department here is committing a lot of errors and law students know better, and so they can use this knowledge as well as we might use our knowledge to help these people. And of course, like the next level would be policy consultancy, but that is way harder to reach, I would reckon.
So if we put the, I like the discussion. If I think of animal movement, dispersal, right? George, you said that it would be strange to sort of capture all the migrating animals and put them behind a wall. But if we think of animal dispersal, that is what we often do. So if we have animal invasive species or plant invasive species that move from one continent to another and don't belong into that ecosystem, then a lot of effort is done to reduce that movement. And in biological or agricultural or environmental protection research, that can be very controversial. Right, how much to interfere with natural dispersal or an induced dispersal. A lot of dispersal today is also induced because of human movement and goods movement across the continents. And then often the question is, if we want to stop dispersal, what kind of techniques can be used? And techniques can involve, say, with a plant, manual eradication of a plant, large groups of primary school students going out into the fields and just stripping the wrong weed off the earth, or a large-scale pesticide release. Right? And there suddenly we have different techniques that one is environmentally friendly and the other one is not, and you have the pesticides. So sometimes when I see or read these reports, I don't know which one is the sort of morally more just thing to do, right? To interfere with that dispersal of a plant or animal species, and in which way to interfere with that. This just as a thought of what we had today, where we looked at animal dispersal and at human migration. But thinking about Lorenz also, do you always know what is the best thing to do? Because very often it's difficult, right? What kind of effect would a particular intervention have? Right? Maybe very often we can judge that on an individual level, but at a more societal level, it's much more difficult, isn't it? Or maybe any thoughts?
Thanks. I can only tell you about the research one of our doctorate students did, and she did research with voluntary people from Germany who tried to help migrants. And she found out, among other things, that those voluntary helpers start having a certain idea about what is good for migrants. So, of course, you have also dynamics there that are difficult to stop. But then from a scientific point of view, if somebody who really dealt with the matters, I think there is some common sense knowledge you can acquire on what's good for the people or what is generally good for it. You cannot really, because you have, people who are traumatized, you can't really generalize everything, but I think there are some advice you can give on what's good for them and what you shouldn't do. And I could add this this student of ours who successfully finished her doctorate studies and is now postdoc. She now does research. Maybe do you know more about her studies right now? She's into social geography now, and she actually tries to find out techniques of keeping animals from migrating. As far as I know, she wants to know how what people try to keep the African schweinepest from European grounds, and that way they try to build walls and stuff like this in order to keep epidemics away from Europe. So it's interesting that some techniques for animals and for human beings seem to be similar. But I can't, yeah.
Yeah, just one sentence to add on that. Actually, it was the case of Denmark, I think, where the same right-wing party that before that had started to prevent migrants, human migrants, from reaching Denmark, have now changed their program in order to keep these animals from getting there. So it's I don't know, funny in a way, but also sad.
Just as the only artist in here, but I think there's sometimes a risk, I hope this isn't going to be unpopular, that as the sort of top, as we see it, top species on this planet, and also as kind of brilliant scientists, that it's quite easy to sometimes think of the people that we're studying, or the species that we're studying, as kind of the other people that we're looking into. And I'm not sure whether, I think the discussion starts here and then the activism comes later and then the fieldwork comes later. And I think that's when all the ideas that you have in places like this become kind of unbelievably brilliant, when you can put them into practice. And I suppose I've seen the other end, in that I've just sat in places and drawn people, but with no real scientific support at all. So it's very reassuring to kind of hear that all of these things exist from the other end of the world to my own.
Thank you all for that discussion. Thank you for the lightning and thunder talks that we had. One thing I think that came out in particular also in the final discussion is that research-based or activism-based, the crucial thing is to know more and to know the people. And also, as you said at the end, if you start knowing the individuals that are behind a particular phenomenon, or the individuals that have to flee the country or want to flee the country, then you start understanding the backgrounds of what that is. And this, in the end, is the topic also that we cover today. Right? The reason we had these lightning talks is to give a glimpse on the topic of migration from very, very different angles, and to give and to share information as large field information, research information, but also as very informal and very personal information from individual people, and using different communication channels. And the one main communication channel that is also open for the next days up to the 12th of July are these pieces of art that we have here. And I would like just to read you a few sentences more about George Butler, and then you can open the mid part of your exhibition. So George Butler is an award-winning artist and illustrator specializing in travel and current affairs. His drawings done in situ are in pen, ink, and watercolor. In August 2012, George walked from Turkey across the border into Syria, where, as guest of the Rebel Free Syrian Army, he drew the civil war damaged the small and empty town of Azaz. Over the last 10 years, then, his desire to record scenes in ink rather than using a photographic system has meant that he has witnessed some extraordinary moments. He went to the refugee camps in Baka Valley, to the old fields in Azerbaijan. He went with Oxfam to Gaza, was in Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Myanmar, Syria, Iraq, and I think this year you went to Yemen, and the list is certainly longer than this. One quote we found: the skill, these are his words in my mouth, the skill is to use drawing as an interview technique for an entire situation. I make visual notes in ink as time passes. It isn't all about conflict. The drawings are of more common experiences than those on our front pages. They are of unfolding scenes, of habits, of stories, or of a single character. His drawings have been published in various sites, in the Times, in the Monocle, in the New York Times, the Guardian, BBC, CNN, Der Spiegel, and many, many more. And he has had exhibitions in many places. Of course, the best place is here and today. right. And that is the place that we are here right now. In 2014, together with three friends, George has set up a Hands Up Foundation. Right. So also here I see a sort of movement from doing something into then also trying to be active and doing something that is directly useful. This Hands Up Foundation has the aim to remind the people that he has met in Syria that they have not been forgotten. The Hands Up Foundation supports salaries of professionals inside Syria and has to date raised over 4 million British pounds. And with this end of the background information, I want to thank you all once more. There are more drinks, there is more food. If you want to add something to the individual works or you want to stand outside with the works, this now is entirely your scene.
That's very kind. Thank you for having it on the walls. I guess the whole point, and I'm going to say one sentence and then we can all go swimming, is that that wherever they are, whether they're on a wall in a fancy London gallery or in a university or on a newspaper page for 50p in London, the whole point is that people see them and that they're only really ever as good as the wall that they're stuck on. So thank you for having them here. It means a lot to be able to talk about them.